Hey team, you're about to experience my interview with Jeremy Horowitz. Jeremy is the founder and MD of Because Ventures. Because Ventures is a VC firm investing specifically in D2C e-commerce brands, and Jeremy is the OG of OGs. I've known him for a long time through LinkedIn. He has helped to build some very large SaaS brands. He's worked in e-commerce for many years. And this guy is just absolutely on fire, and he knows what it takes to build successful D2C brands. You're going to learn all about it. Enjoy. Welcome to Mentoring Moments. Mentoring Moments is a sub-series of the E-commerce Edge podcast. It is composed of clips taken from Jason's one-to-one and group mentorship sessions. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another amazing episode of the E-commerce Edge. It is my great pleasure to welcome guest mentor Jeremy Horowitz to the pod today. Welcome, Jeremy.
Thank you for having me. You're really excited to be on, Jason. I feel like this is the first time we're actually talking face-to-face after knowing each other for years, like through LinkedIn, newsletters, that kind of stuff. So really excited to be here.
We've done some cool stuff. I've tried to comment on and interact with your content. You've done the same with me. I think we've been connected on LinkedIn for maybe 4+ years now. And so we've known each other from afar. I've watched you. I have been a fan of yours. I love your content. I love your no bullshit style. I think it mirrors my style quite a lot in the sense that we cut to the chase and we call a spade. I love Gorgeous. I love the work that you used to do at Gorgeous. I love the fact that you've thrown in the towel on that and gone all in on your own thing now, buying, investing in, and advising D2C brands. I love the fact that you are building in public and you are so transparent and Investment Fridays and talking about, for example, how you are generating deal flow, the conversations you're having, what's working, what's not working, where you have not met the goals that you set for yourself in a given week. You're real and you're raw, and I'm so here for it, man.
Thank you. I feel like we're two kindred spirits in that respect, because I'd say all of the same things about you. So excited to dive in today.
Yeah, look, thank you. And it definitely feels like kindred spirits to me. And what I really wanted to get more into the nuts and bolts of today is that as a guest mentor, I think you have so much value to add, particularly to D2C brands who perhaps either are in the early stages of their growth journey, or they set up during COVID when the TAM, the total addressable market for D2C brands exploded because everybody was forced to buy online. And then all of a sudden, once COVID came to the end, everybody flocked back to physical retail. Still to this day, 70-80% of all retail dollars are spent in physical stores. And so there's been a lot of D2C brands that have gone under over the last 12 months. There's a lot of brands that are struggling. There's more competition than ever before. The barrier to entry is lower than it's ever been into getting online with the likes of Shopify and the what I call the triumvirate of Shopify, Klaviyo, and Gorgeous. It seems to be the standard stack that just about, and then on the back end, everybody either runs QuickBooks or Xero when they first start out, and it's business in a box kind of stuff. And I think that I spend a lot of time on Reddit. I spend a lot of time on LinkedIn. I spend a lot of time on Quora. And I see posts literally every single day. Oh, I've started up this new online business on Shopify. I run Gorgeous. I run Klaviyo. I've spent $2,000, $5,000, $10,000 on ads. I'm getting traffic to my website, but I have zero sales. I don't know what to do. I'm pulling my hair out. And so we see, it's so interesting because I think most industries, people realize you need to have a certain amount of skill. You need to have a certain amount of training, experience, maybe even a degree. No one would think about going and being a doctor or a lawyer or a psychologist or whatever. They would never think of doing that without having some form of education or degree. They would, or a tradie. Nobody's going to go and think, oh, I can go and build a house or do plumbing or whatever it is. That they have the expectation that they need to go and they need to build up a skill set and a suite of experience and a suite of training that will make them good enough at this job to be able to do it successfully. But it's so bizarre. For some reason, I think Shopify is to blame to a degree, because I watch the ads, the Shopify ads with all the merchants out there that have had success on Shopify, and they make it sound so easy to build a successful online brand, and that is just not, is it?
Yeah, it's one of those things of I love that about the space. So I used to host a podcast. One question I ask every single guest is, how'd you get into e-com? And I had 160 episodes and got 160 different responses. One person actually did go to school for e-com. That was like my fascinating insight. Everybody else, like me, just you fall into an ass backwards. If you're doing something else, you figured you could sell something online, and then you just, you know, we're all here and we're all going to retire from here. Yeah, I would say that I think what's really fascinating to me about this game is there are 700 ways to get really good at one thing, and you need to master that. And so for some people, you're a meta expert and you just live in the ads platform. For other people, it's SEO. For other people, it's you're really great at supply chain or drop shipping or something else. So that's what I love about this game. I think that you have to learn on the job how to be great at one thing, right? It's not like you're a master of meta ads, or you're a master of marketing, SEO, one of those things. And so it's almost usually two people on the team. Someone's amazing at the sales. Someone's amazing at the ops portion of it. And then you just figure everything else on the job. I think that nobody really comes in being an expert in this, and you have to learn on the job. And Shopify has definitely broken down, I want to say Shopify, the Chinese government, and then like supply chain becoming more as a service has really broken down those barriers that anybody coming off the street has an idea can go figure out how to fully launch a brand. And yeah, nobody's a meta expert or an email expert or SEO expert coming in, or on the other up, like a product or ops expert. But you learn those things on the job. And that's just like the daunting and really exciting part about all this. And then as you go build those skills, then you're like, okay, I know this person and they run an agency and they do X and they this other person does Y. And then you just cobble it all together, which is why so many e-commerce brands, especially until they get to 8 figures, look like just spit and duct tape is holding them together. And then once they get there, it's okay, let's really build a brand here. Let's really hire the people that we need to. Let's really build the components that a business would need. But it's fascinating to see there's probably 80,000 brands on Shopify doing about $1 million or more in GMV a year. And of all those brands, a lot of them are in that $1 to $5 million range. And yeah, it's just like a guy or gal who had an idea, threw up some ads or something on the internet, and here we are years later, we're making pretty good money.
Yeah. And I do think though, that especially nowadays, because you're right, you can't, there's not too many universities or institutions out there that offer e-commerce training or an e-commerce degree. They might offer a commerce degree or a business degree or a marketing degree that maybe has some digital elements to it, but you can't go to school and get an e-commerce degree because first of all, schools don't offer it. Second of all, even if they did, the curriculum would be outdated the month after they release it. So what I oftentimes, from an advice perspective, and I'd love your thoughts on this, is I say these people that have started up these brands, if oftentimes it's best if they do one of two things, either start up their e-commerce business as a side hustle. Don't necessarily, and there's two schools of thought on this, burn the boats, go all in, figure it out as fast as you can and try to make a living from it. And I would say if you're single, you're young, you don't really have anything to lose, maybe yes. But if you've got a home, a mortgage, kids, car payments, everything else, chucking in a job that maybe you're making 180, between 80 and 200 grand a year on to go all in on this new business that you're still learning about, possibly a really risky way to go. And I would say either do it as a side hustle at first or go and freaking work for an e-commerce brand that has it figured out. Get close to the sun. Get into the business. Learn how these brands work. Learn how they build traffic. Learn how they build audience, learn how they build brand, learn how they do logistics, learn the ins and outs, the inner workings of a successful e-commerce brand, and be willing to be humble and learn from the bottom, work your way from the bottom up, or go and work for an agency. Because the reality is you are going to learn so much so fast in an agency environment because you're going to be exposed to lots of different brands, lots of different business models, lots of different verticals. And you're going to also be able to potentially move across multiple different types of roles within that agency to figure out which part of e-commerce that you like. Because like you say, I came into this, and in fact, all of my peers that are around my age, so let's say somewhere between 30 and 50 years old, all of the people that I know in this industry, like you said, there is no one pathway that we all came. I fell into this industry through a mutual friend. That's how I came into this industry. And I loved it from day one. And I've been at it ever since for over 20 years. And I know a lot of people that have fallen into the industry for whatever reason. And because the industry is so broad now, basically, if you're a creative, there's room for you in this industry. If you're a tech bro, there's room for you in this industry. If you are into, if you're an ops leader, an ops specialist, there's room for you in this industry. If you're a finance person, a numbers person, there's room for you in this industry. It doesn't matter where your interests lie or what your background is, there is room for you in this industry. But the challenge I see is that this whole, the ease of standing up a Shopify store with a Gorgeous, with a Klaviyo, with a QuickBooks on the back end, it gives the illusion that just because you are able to stand up a store, that you are able to run a successful business. And those are two very different things, aren't they?
Yeah, definitely. Actually, I would take the hard line on your point. In e-com specifically, I wouldn't burn the boats on this business. And it's just one simple practice. E-com businesses, as they grow, suck up more cash. So if you're looking to make a quick buck, if you're actually looking to make a lot of money on a yearly basis, go start an agency or go start something in the services, because that literally is cash in your pocket. It's a high cash flow business. As you scale and you really start to feel this pain, probably when you start to hit about $1 million in GMV, and then it's super painful until about 25 to 50 million in GMV, because that's when, you know, the debt providers and the real financing providers will come and fund a lot of your, or not fund, lever and let you
factor. Be interested.
Yeah, be able, not even interested, but just like, they'll literally give you a reasonable line of debt to fund your inventory versus every single dollar that you just made in profit, you now have to go plow back into your next PO from China, your, or wherever you get your inventory from, as well as your ads or whatever's propelling your business forward. And yeah, I would say that if you want to make a quick buck, e-com is a great way to make a long dollar. If you're in this game forever, if you actually change someone's consumer behavior, and I use that term pretty loosely, because I would have to say like B2B, there's a consumer behavior there as well. And so I would say like if you want to make a lot of money over a decade, two decades, three decade long time frame, e-commerce is great. If you want to make a quick buck in the next 6 months, e-commerce is terrible because it's just going to suck up all of your cash, especially if you pay for inventory before you sell it.
And you're paying, I think these people need to think of it as an education. Okay, they didn't go to university for e-commerce, but when they stand up their store and I read about them on Reddit, having gone and spent $2, $5, $10 grand on ads, and maybe they're getting a little bit of traffic, but they've made no sales or one or two sales. And I want to scream through the screen and say, welcome to e-commerce and welcome to your education. Think of it as an opportunity to learn, not an opportunity to earn. Because in the first 1, 2, 3, 4 years, that's probably what it is going to be. It's not going to be an opportunity to earn. It is going to be an opportunity to learn. It is going to be a self-education, and it is going to cause you to do some serious gut checks and some serious introspection, because it's going to be much, much harder than you ever thought it could be. Because the barrier to entry, it's perverse, but as the barrier to entry has come down to setting up an online business initially, so has the competition gone up. And also the bigger, more entrenched players, both individual D2C pure plays, as well as the Amazons and the other marketplaces of the world, social sellers, et cetera, the competition has absolutely gone through the roof. And so they've sucked all the oxygen out of the e-commerce room.
Yeah, I would say that you, like, it's interesting, I was having this conversation earlier with someone else today too. I think it's never been harder to start a Me Too brand, but never better to start a truly unique brand. Because I do think that I've seen some brands that are truly unique in this space that have the fastest I've ever seen gone from 0 to 8 figures, 0 to 9 figures. Like, we're talking about under 36 months, which I know seems really normal with headlines now, but for, you know, two old head gray white beards like us, we remember the days where that took a decade and a half. And so I think that is really interesting. Of, it's easier, the logistic and infrastructure is there, and the ads, if you have the cash flow and just raw like volume of dollars, you can go do that. But it's hardest to become, I don't know, the 500th legging brand or the 7,000th clean beauty brand out there. Like, it's so competitive. Consumers are so overwhelmed by what's the marginal difference from what I'm looking at, that you really need to be very creative in your positioning. Because I don't think it's actually necessarily that you need to spend 17 years in R&D and come up with the most innovative blah, blah, blah anymore. Like, True Classic, I think, is a great example of this. They make t-shirts. No offense to them. I think it's a great business. Big fan of it. I'm not a personally customer. Totally get why people love it. But they make plain colored t-shirts. Let's just be frank here. Like, it's a very simple business model. But they absolutely nailed their positioning. And that's why they went from 0 to 150 million bootstrapped in under 3 years.
And don't all the tech bros wear their shirts now? Like, basically, isn't the office clothing line that every tech bro has to be wearing, has to have 53 black t-shirts in their closet because they don't want to waste any mental bandwidth deciding what they're going to clothe themselves with each day?
Yeah, the Steve Jobs effect. Yeah, so, right, like, again, like, positioning, absolutely nailed it. And I think today it's all just a game of eyeballs. And I think Gary Vee nailed this a decade ago, so I'm not going to take any credit here. But all of the biggest, fastest growing brands I know, Dr. Squatch, Liquid Death, True Classic, they all know how to optimize for eyeballs. And they're also like, that's the new ad algorithm arbitrage. That's the new way that you get a ton of, I would say, better spend on your dollar is to do something that truly stands out in people's feeds. And that's why they're growing so quickly. And that's why you see all of these nine-figure brands who have these huge brands. Or you can go Hex Squad and you just go, we have a famous celebrity. This guy's all over TV. He's in our ads now. You like him, buy. I've been worked at a brand that did a similar concept there. It's pretty expensive, but it doesn't work very effectively. But for everybody else, right, like the Dr. Squatch guy, who knew who that guy was before he started doing Dr. Squatch ads? Now you associate that guy to that brand and it's super successful. And so I think really it's all about just being super, super unique. And I think the farther you can go out on that spectrum and even like almost push that to the outer limits of what people think is acceptable. And I think Liquid Death has like nailed that part of it. Like they tase people in an ad. I don't know if everybody's seen that. Highly recommend like Liquid Death Taser. It's a great, really funny ad. But like really, what can you do to get earned media out of your content creative? And I think Crocs is actually the best example here. I know everybody like loves to make fun of them and loves to say it's not a real product and all these other things. They have 63 stunt collabs they do throughout a year. Everything from Hello Kitty to NASCAR. And like everything you can think of in between those two things, like they are doing it and they're doing collabs with those brands. And it's not really anything to do with the actual product sales. Like they're not trying to make millions or billions of dollars off of Balenciaga Crocs, but you're going to capture a ton of eyeballs and a ton of earned media. And I think we're just in that wave now. D2C 1.0, we had to do with a lot of like supply chain logistics, tech infrastructure. And I already realize how old I sound here by people's eyes glazing over by this stuff. But I really believe that this like Shopify 2.0 wave is going to be determined by marketing. Everything else is done. You're going to get a product in a certain amount of time. It's going to have a pretty good experience. You're going to have some unboxing experience. You're going to get into retail. You're going to get into marketplace. And then it's just really like, why buy this thing? And how can you get 10 times more views than the next person? Because that's really what's going to win in today's environment.
Eyeballs and distribution, those feel like the two things, right? If you can't get attention, if you can't get attention for your brand and you can't get it cheaply, you're going to struggle. And if you can't get distribution and you can't get into markets that you can't access directly, then you're going to really struggle. And as someone who has really doubled down on the B2B side of e-commerce over the last few years, I come from a long history of B2C and D2C e-commerce, but latterly I've doubled down on B2B. And I'd love your thoughts on D2C brands establishing strategic wholesale. Because we've seen the dangers, the likes of Allbirds, and I can rattle off probably a 10 more D2C brands off the top of my head that either still don't do strategic wholesale or were very late to the strategic wholesale game. And the reality is what we're seeing is that even strong D2C brands, they can't get in front of, no matter how much money they spend, no matter how hard they try, no matter how many physical retail stores they have, they cannot get in front of every single potential customer in their market. There are pockets of the market that are loyal to other brands, other retail chains, other distribution channels that they're loyal in those areas, or that's where they typically buy through and they don't look further afield. So you're never going to be able to get a digital ad in front of them. You're never going to be able to get a social ad in front of them for whatever reason. And I think that strategic wholesale is the next great channel for strong D2C brands. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, it's just really funny how everything, you unbundle something, you rebundle something, and the cycles just repeat itself. So for context for everybody in the audience, like my real major prime time side on the D2C side was I was brought into a brand that was going through a massive retail expansion. They brought me in to run D2C. So I ran Shopify, Amazon, retention marketing, and then also paid marketing. And on the retail side, like we're talking Apple, Sprint, Verizon, Best Buy, like mass Target, like massive, huge multi-door chains, international as well. And this is back in the Shopify 1.0 days, 2015, 2017, 2018 timeframe, where like we were fighting, it was called DNVB back then. That's also like how I got to stop aging myself here. It was, D2C didn't even exist at that point. Could we convince people just to buy online? And could we convince people to give us our credit cards? Like it was still that, it's hard to think about, but it was still that point where you had to put like the little lock icon at checkout so that people didn't think you were scamming them. While retail was the thing. And I think for better or worse, what we all did coming out of that was we swung too far on the pendulum the other way and we over-indexed to D2C. And yeah, we're still seeing this wash out. You had a great newsletter in my Let's Buy a Biz weekly newsletter where you just tore Allbirds shred fairly because who knows what they're doing. Retail is inevitable. I think like everybody needs to re-architect their brain. if your brand cannot get into retail, you don't have a brand. And I think that's what like a lot of people mistake is you want to be in marketplace. You want to be in retail. You want to be if you make the product and if you are selling the product, your job is to sell that everywhere to as many people for as affordable as possible. And especially when we look at acquiring a brand, especially on the like earlier side, close to that like 10 to 20 million, we want to see them have a lot of success in D2C, but they need to have all the components to get into Amazon and retail and all those other components. Because as you go from 1 to 10, D2C, if your product should work in D2C, if it doesn't, think about other channels. From 10 to 100, you almost have to go marketplace, if not and retail, like both. And then 100 million plus, it has to be in retail. And I don't know, Allbirds is a good example. It didn't work for them post 100 million. Who else blew up? Casper blew up post 100 million.
8Sleep. Like there's so many. There's a whole list of these brands. Even BarkBox. There's just so many of these D2C brands that just, they fell over. And NBC recently put out a article on how many D2C darlings that rose through the pandemic and then went public. How many of those either have been taken private, gone out of business, their share price has been cut in half or less. Like it's a bloodbath out there for a lot of those COVID-born D2C sweethearts.
Yeah. I would say the only company I can think of off the top of my head that is still at meaningful scale, purely D2C, is Chewy.
Yes.
And if you can nail an enormous TAM, getting a ton of subscribers to every month need more consumables, and you can really hit that level, yes, I still question whether Chewy should be D2C. I think they should move into other channels. They're doing well and pretty big. But yeah, they're the only company I can think of who doesn't have it. And I think everybody just needs to shift their mind of it's not a, like this D2C or die mania needs to stop, or I'm not an Amazon brand, or all these other ludicrous things. Like what is working really well today? Put your foot all the way down on the gas pedal, go as far as you can. A great brand, D2C, right mix should get to about $50 million. If you're in the right market, right product, you have all the right components. You should be able to scale about $50 million top line, one channel, couple marketing, like one sales channel, couple marketing channels, great product. You add other products to that, you should probably get north of 75, close to 100 million. And then that's when you need to start going multi-product if you're in a truly great product and market. Hard to do. Truly great brands live in that space. You have to start moving into other channels along that journey. And I think the other piece that like, I think it's super important that you brought up is the brands that I know get it. Think of retail as a marketing channel that you make dollars from.
Yes.
Is that it's a brand. There's a brand halo that I know everybody hates to talk about. But if I go see you in Target and I get an ad from you on Facebook and then I get an email and a this, that, the other, like, right, like you need to make the math work that you can spend all those marketing dollars, whether they buy it from Target or your website. But that's the goal. Like I grab in Target, I order more online, I go to Amazon, it's there. I think people get so wrapped up in the incremental margins of all of these channels. I've looked through 300 P&Ls of both private and public companies in the past couple of years. Your net income margin always falls to 10 to 15% if you're a great brand, no matter what channel. As all these channels scale, it always comes back down to the same thing. And you have the
same average.
The same profits across all three. There's no difference once you hit real meaningful scale on this whole myth that if you go fully vertical and you're digitally native and you go D2C, you'll have all this extra margin. You're just paying Facebook.
No, because you're going to spend for the acquisition. You're going to pay for the acquisition. And if you go with distributed retail and use strategic wholesale, then you're going to be giving the same margin away that you were giving in CAC because of the reduced margins on wholesale. So I see what you're saying. It's basically like, there's no free lunch is basically what you're saying.
Exactly. And so I think where retail scares a lot of, especially I think earlier founders and younger brands, is the mistake of going too far into too many channels, because that is where it gets gnarly. And that is where you get a lot of problems, because you've probably levered up on a lot of debt to then fund a lot of the inventory because your sales cycle is longer, right? You need to buy inventory, ship it to a retailer. They need to sell it. They need to get the money, and then they need to get that money back to you. And that cycle is a lot longer. So you do need to think about the cash flow of your business, right? Because some brands will die between the PO and getting the money back. And you need to be at a size of business that you can support that, or have some sort of infrastructure like funding or a good credit line.
Or what's happening now, because interest rates are so low in China, the Chinese manufacturers are funding and saying, we're going to give you net 90 and then you give your customer, your wholesale customers, net 30, net 60, then effectively your manufacturer, contract manufacturers are floating your inventory effectively. So that's an arbitrage that's happening right now. High interest rates in the West, low interest rates in Asia. There's an arbitrage happening there.
Yeah. I also love that this is like a new arbitrage or like a new tactic. If everyone leaves this podcast for one insight, this is it. The best businesses have the best rates with their suppliers. The goal of this is to have as much cash come in your door before cash goes out of the door. I know it sounds pretty obvious, but when you're negotiating with your supplier, this is where I see every single brand miss the mark. Negotiate the best possible payback terms possible. Just anything you can negotiate. 15 days, 30 days, 90 days. I know some brands who have a year right now until they have to pay their supplier back for their inventory. That, it's someone who has done VC investment, angel investment, as a private equity, I'm negotiating against myself here because you will grow so much faster if you just extend your payment to your supplier than if you take on funding. And I think that this is what so many brands have missed, where this is the new arbitrage. And you do make a good point, like literally an interest rate difference is now a new financial like equilibrium that we live in, which makes it even better. But if your supplier is American, Mexican, in Vietnam, anywhere, negotiate longer rates from them. This is what will allow you to unlock your business faster, because what it'll allow you to do is, let's say you have 90 days to pay your supplier back for your inventory, and it's even D2C. You can run ads, make a sale, you make the money back in your bank account in 3 days, you put it back into ads, you sell it again, and you do that over and over a three-day period. If you have 90 days to pay your supplier back, you can probably turn that dollar, I don't know, let's keep it simple, 10 times. Mm-hmm. And so if you can do that really well, even 5 times, let's keep it simple, even 5 times, you made 5 times the amount of sales before your cash has had to go out to your supplier. And why that's so crucial, and that's actually the first thing we do when we go in to buy, acquire a business, is we go and we say, okay, how can we collect as much money as quickly as possible? How can we delay paying everybody for as long as possible? And that's almost always negotiating with suppliers because of that exactly. It just gives you more time to breathe, but also gives you more cash to cycle through the business faster. And that's how you really unlock growth in this game.
I love the saying that Cody Sanchez has, what she says when she goes in to buy a business. And I think this applies in supplier negotiations as well. She says, I'll tell a business owner that I'm looking to buy them out of the business. You can dictate the price or the terms, but not both. So you can tell me what the price is, or you can tell me what the terms are, but then I'll take the other side of that coin. So if you tell me what the terms are, I'll tell you what I'm willing to pay, and vice versa. If you want to set the price, then I'll dictate the terms. And that's way that way the negotiation is fair and equitable on both sides. And I would say you can take that same mentality and mindset into your supplier negotiations and say, hey, look, I'm willing to pay a slightly higher unit price, for example, if you're going to give me 90, 120, six month, 180 day terms, if you're going to give me really favorable terms, then also I can suffer a slightly smaller margin on every sale, because now I'm going to be able to bring momentum to my turnover of my money. I'm going to be able to bring much more momentum. And like you say, it's like restaurants, right? They're all about how many turns can they get in a night? It's how many seats at a table, how many times can we get somebody in those seats, bums on seats, spending money in a given window of time. It's exactly the same concept within e-commerce.
Any business. Like that is the literal core fundamental of all business. It's called a negative cash conversion cycle. It's just, can you get cash in your door before cash leaves your door? Because that, right, the number one killer of any business is cash flow. If you run out of cash flow, you're dead. And so the longer you can extend that cash leaving your bank account, the more you can do with it. And yeah, it's a great Sanchez quote. There's another favorite line. Sure, I'll buy this business for $1 billion. I'll just give you $1 a day for the next, whatever it is, hundreds of years. And so I think I always think of it as the founder is the largest investor in the business, right? No matter who actually owns the cap table, no matter what the actual percentages are, board seats, whatever. If you're running a business right now, you have invested the most in your business. Think like an investor, right? How can I get as much cash out of this business? How can I leverage the cash of this business the most? Because essentially it is an asset. Like, I think an interesting thing that I've seen, especially as this kind of like post-COVID, post kind of recession, is a lot of founders seem like they're just done. There just seems to be this group of people. Hey, we've been at this. We started this business before COVID. We wrote it where we were fulfilling orders for 15 days during lockdowns. Then we wrote it back up with the craziness of this. And then Meta, iOS 14, and we're just done. And a lot of conversations I've been having with founders recently is, do you actually want to part with this asset or not? Or do you want to just bring in an operator? You take a back seat and run it. And I think like having that mindset now really builds a successful business, no matter what you do, whether you exit it, whether you run it forever, whether you have someone else run it. You really need to think about it that way, because I know for a lot of people, this is like your livelihood, your blood, sweat, and tears. Like, I've started 8 companies over my time here. That's a big reason why I like try to share so much, is I wanted this when I was younger, someone to actually share what actually goes on in these rooms, what goes on in these meetings, and all those other things. But like, you just need to think about, what's the longevity of this business? What is the cash flow of this business? How is this supporting me? Because otherwise, you honestly just have a really high, stressful, not that great paying job. Like, there's your skill set running a multi-million dollar e-com brand, and you're like, if it's not profitable and it's not cash flowing, you can make a ton more money in other industries with the exact same skill set.
Hey team, I have a big favor to ask you. Please pause this episode and send the link of this episode to someone you know that you think would enjoy this content. Really appreciate you spreading the word. This is how we grow. We're not a Joe Rogan. We don't have big, massive advertising budgets, but we absolutely want to grow. We want to get the learnings from all of these episodes out to as wide of an audience as possible, and we need your help to do it. Thank you, and now back to your listening. You can make a ton more money just going and being an employee of a really well-run business, or going and being a bank employee, or going and being a tradie, or going and being almost anything else. That's the reality. And I think the people, unfortunately, their personal brand and their personal sense of self-worth is so wedded to their business that they can't see a future without that business being part of their identity. And I think this is a risk. This is the danger. And I think for a lot of entrepreneurs, and it's not just in e-commerce, I think entrepreneurs full stop, their sense of self-worth is very much tied up into their business value, their business growth, their business success. And I think it's even more of an issue for guys than girls or women. I think women tend to be a little bit more level-headed about this kind of thing. And they tend to make, in some respects, better business leaders, because they can separate their personal self-worth from business success. And I think that, unfortunately, what happens, especially for guys, is that they will stay in a business. And I know this firsthand, because my first business, which was an e-commerce pure play brand, and we were selling direct to consumer, at the end, we should have sold. Like, we had people interested in buying the business 1 year in, 2 years in, 3 years in, and we thought that the opportunity was going to be there forever. So we just held on to it. And then in the end, sold it for basically the value of the stock and a bit of brand goodwill and chattels and a few other things, and wasn't in debt, but ended up selling it for next to nothing. And I look back on that, and you have to know when to get into a business, but you also have to know when to get out. And that's what it feels like to me. And if your self-worth is tied up too much in a business, it doesn't allow you to be able to make those objective business decisions that you need to make.
Yeah, definitely. I think I had the exact same problem when I was younger. And you spend all your time in it, thinking about it, doing it like it is. Okay, I can quantify the like value of my effort here, especially because I'm probably am passing up making a lot of money somewhere else. One that I heard in a podcast that like really shifted my entire perspective on this is, entrepreneurship is just surfing, to your point. Like, to your point, you literally just need to catch a wave. You need to know when to ride it up. You need to know when to ride it down. You need to know when it's too windy or
to bail off the board. You need to know when to bail off the board
and get out of the ocean. And I think that has been really helpful for me. I think also, like, on a personal level, as you just get older, like, I'm now married, I adopted a dog, I have a social circle of friends. Like, my business isn't necessarily my entire life anymore. I just spend an inordinate amount of time working. But there are other things that help there. And I think that's also a big part that's like really hard when you're in that just grind all the time and completely dedicated to this mindset is, and I'm say as do as I say, not as I do. I don't have any good hobbies now, but I think hobbies really help there, or figuring it's just something to do that's not the business. Because I think it like, it's really hard to say, especially like not being in the seat currently, but like, this is just a game. Like, business is just a game. It's meant to be played. It shouldn't be taken too seriously, because at the end of the day, all businesses go out of business. Everybody makes money. Everybody loses money. As long as you're in it long.
Nobody gets out alive. Nobody gets out of this life alive.
I wasn't going to go there, but yeah. And so I think that's the other piece to really just keep in mind is there's always the great risk is great reward. And there's always that you can put your chips on the table and risk it all. But at the end of the day, like, the people who are super successful in this just do it for a really long time. The most successful people just do it for 30, 40 years, and especially consumer. It's not crypto or software where you might be able to quickly turn something. Like, you want to change people's behavior, especially if you're doing D2C, like true consumer marketing. Changing people's hate consumer, like, changing their behavior takes decades. Like,
generations.
Nike, yeah,
like, of buyers.
Nike is because they've been around for 50 years. Ford is Ford. They're easy things to say, But this anomaly, and I think we're all just wrapped up in the past 4 years, like this anomaly, you start a brand, it becomes this massive overnight success. And it's this huge thing. Just like, it shouldn't be the goal. It shouldn't be the purpose. There are other and better and faster ways to make that much money. And I recommend, if that's your thing, go into those lanes. Like, consumer business, you do it because the consumers love it. And you have some deep down part of you that like needs that like validation that someone else loves what you did and what you worked on. And to me, it's like very similar to art in that respect, where it's not easy to always pin like that's going to be successful. But when you just capture that moment, I haven't really done it too many times, but from the moments I've had to participate, like it is validating. Like I assume it's what an artist feels like when their movie is super successful or everybody loves their painting or whatever. And I think that's the key point of this. And the people who like tap into that and figure out how to do that over a long enough point in time are the people who are also insanely wealthy, because they've generated so much, just so much value for other people in the world, and figured out an intelligent way to capture a portion of that value that they've created.
And now that you're on the other side of the fence and you've gotten out of the active day-to-day and you're now looking at acquiring or investing in some of these D2C brands, what are some of the things when you put your qualification list together and you say, when I go in and I'm doing my due diligence, these are the 3, 4, 5, 10 things that I'm looking at before I would even consider investing in one of these businesses? Is it that they've got their ops nailed? Is it that they've got logistics nailed? Is it that they've got cash flow nailed? Is it that they've got a point of differentiation? Is it the fact that the founder has grit and has lived through some really hard times and fought through that? What are some of the key attributes, both of the leadership and the business itself, that you look for before you would ever think of investing a dime in a D2C brand?
Yeah. So I'll take it through two lanes, and this is actually primarily how we invest. So we do distressed assets, which are basically like they cannot pay their bills. They have some sort of loan that's come up that they don't have the cash flow for. A good way to summarize is good business, bad balance sheets. In that, we're coming in and completely taking over the business. So I'd say our core criteria under both is, first, we're looking for a business that has over 50% gross margin. For our particular flair and for what we like to work on is more than 50% of their sales are D2C, primarily from a Shopify store. And that's just because a lot of our playbook is getting them onto marketplaces, scaling them through other channels, working with retail partners to scale that up. There are plenty of other people who are great at retail and great at marketplace first. That's just not our specific thing. I'd say the third piece is, and this is probably a little counterintuitive, I actually want to see a really high concentration of sales. I think a really big mistake that people make, and we're typically looking at pretty small catalog companies, sub 100 SKUs, really ideally sub 25. I think the mistake everybody makes is the more is more, especially when you're early. If you're under $50 million in sales, your product catalog shouldn't be more than 50 SKUs. Like you haven't found the right product if you have a really big catalog and a really small amount of sales. And I'm saying really small pretty loosely, like in the terms of billions, hundreds of billions. Like you should have one hit product that you can aggressively scale. What we also typically find in those businesses is that they've mastered one thing, or they're doing one thing pretty well, but then nothing else. So they're good at ads, but they have no email and retention program. One company I've looked at today doesn't even send emails. Like they have whatever it was, 50,000 email subscribers, and that's the right face to make. They're just like, yeah, we don't sign emails. So I was like, cool. Okay, that's a good
option. This is a lever we can pull.
Yes. The second one we almost always see, and please do this for your business right now because it is actually the most applicable for any business. They don't optimize their AOV. I come in, I buy a product, that's it. And I remember being those days. I remember, okay, we just got to get as many people to buy as possible and just turn the cash register. No. Someone comes in to buy a product. What is a cheap product you can slap on? What is another product that they will buy together?
Cross sells, upsells, bundles, kits, gifting. There's a million different ways to think of this, right?
Exactly. Bounce backs. Hey, you bought this. Next purchase, think of this other product or this other category we have. All of those things. That is second thing. Negotiate terms with your suppliers. Maximize your AOV. Those are the two actual fastest ways you will grow your brand. Because you're going to turn more dollars. Usually they don't have that optimized. There's a lot of missing pieces there. It's way over focused on selling one product or not selling any product at all. And so what we almost always do is we almost always cut half the catalog. And it's always shocking when I go and do this exercise, almost nothing ever happens to the brand. They're like, oh my God, we have to have all these products on site. We cut half of them. Brand's completely fine. It actually makes more money because of a consumer principle of if you confuse, you lose. And the paradox
Correct.
Of choice, right?
Like the mental bandwidth to make a decision, people don't like it.
Yeah. And also if you're running people through a Meta ad on their phone and expecting them to buy in 60 seconds, I can't decide between seven options of a similar product that quickly. And so I would say that's number 3/4. Let's call it 3, optimize AOV, 4, slim the catalog down and really nail that one thing. And I would say the fifth thing is just a lack of positioning. And I think I'll go into the keto space because I think these brands did it well. Magic Spoon, for example, we make keto cereal because keto is hot, but that also solves the diabetes problem. And if I have diabetes, I need to have low sugar and low carb cereal because of my physical condition. Then they went after the low sugar market. And so taking the same thing and just figuring out how to reposition it sometimes can unlock a significantly bigger market. And Stanley is the best example of that. 4 years ago, they saw women posting colored old mugs on TikTok. They went all in on that strategy. It was the CEO was an ex-CMO of Crocs. That's how they
there we go. Makes sense. He's repeating the playbook.
Yeah, and he literally is. And taking that natural trend, who at the time, it was a $75 million business selling thermoses to working men. Who knew that it would be a $800 million business because women would like multiple colors? Now it's super obvious, but back then it was like, hey, that's interesting, and that's a unique trend. And just figuring
out. Well, and Stanley was a toolbox historically, and tools actually for that matter, and box cutters and things like that. And now they drive most revenue through chili cups. It's just mental.
Yeah. Yeah. With straws and pastel colors. And so I think that's number 5 is the ops pieces is usually something around we're not shipping our product, we're not ordering our product. Like we seem to smooth out the operations piece. Or maybe
we're not maximizing the use of our physical warehouse space because we don't have a WMS and we're not doing chaotic put away or we don't have an efficient 3PL service that we're working with, or it could be 100 different things to do with that set of load of warehousing, pick, pack, dispatch, shipment piece.
Yeah, exactly. And I think on that piece, I'll just say, because I'm usually more on the go-to-market side, my partner's usually more the operations and infrastructure piece, like you have to have an incredibly compelling reason to not use a 3PL at this point. I know everybody hates their 3PL. I know every 3PL has its own problems, but like you just really, especially sub $50, $100 million, really have to think through what are you absolutely the best at? And for 99% of brands, I can guarantee you it is not shipping your product. So hard. And maybe you have a super specific product and maybe you have a super specific niche case. Like that one doesn't apply to you. But almost always it's move it to a 3PL, move it to a better fulfillment provider, someone who actually...
FBA, whatever it is, if you're on the FBA channel.
Yeah, and that's one of my big predictions is FBA for all is going to be here in 5 years anyway. So like, why am I killing myself trying to hire day laborers and figure out robots?
Or getting robotics into my warehouse or whatever.
Yeah, like it's just thinking about like where your highest leverage time is, it's not going to be there. And so really those are the five core components. On the investment side, when we're doing a growth round, so we're taking a minority position, something sub 50%, I'd say it's a lot of the similar things. The couple pieces I'll layer on there is enormous TAM. You just need to be in a big market. This whole, I think the nuance that's missing in the old phrase of pick a niche and get rich is that you need to be a niche within a massive market. You're not going to become rich selling some super small, obscure, esoteric thing to a very small community because someone will, my other favorite quote is profits will always get competed away in a capitalistic market. Someone will always come eat your lunch. And so you need to be somewhere big enough that you can eat someone else's lunch. You don't go under if someone tries to eat your lunch and you just are a really big market. Also, the other thing that usually comes out of that, if you are intelligent about how you carve out your space in that big market, is there's another big market over here that with some creative positioning or with some product expansion and some resources you can dive into. And now you have two massive markets that you sit in between. And that's how people really make money. And I would say to end it, the most important thing when we're looking for an investment in a growth round where someone else is running the business is the founder needs to vehemently with their existential core body and soul believe in what they're doing. And I never want to look at business plans. I don't believe in business plans. I don't care about business plans. I think business plans are a waste of time. I want to know why when you get punched 75 times in the face, aren't making any money, and this business is literally on death's doorstep, you are like, let's go all in. I'm in for the next round. Because to be honest, like that's the other just candid part about this space. there's going to be ebbs and flows. It's going to be a roller coaster. There's going to be parts where it's
got to have grit
in your life. Yeah. And there's going to be parts where it's honestly just the worst days of your life. And you ask yourself, why would I ever do this? And it's really, again, it's about survival. It's just, can you get off of that low point climb? Because in the moment, it's this. Over a long time frame, it's honestly just that. Even when you have the exponential growth, it comes back and it just reverts back to a very long mean. And so it's just, can you survive long enough to make this thing successful?
And I think almost all those things, when we think about like the Operators Podcast and Hexclad and Ridge and all those guys, I think that when we look at all the great D2C brands out there that we hold up today that are profitable, they're growing, they have great margins, they have a defensible moat, they're not producing something that's so novel that it's a new category. They're going into existing old categories, but what they are is they're innovating within a category. They are adding adjacent products. And if we look at Ridge and them adding men's wedding rings, who would have thought, right? But that's a total adjacency, right? And it makes complete sense why they would go into that. And they've talked about through that on the podcast. And so I think all of the attributes that you've just been speaking about, being strong in one area, at least from either a product and or a marketing perspective, getting your channel mix, but not spreading yourself too thin, moving into adjacencies in terms of products, having a small, manageable catalog of products that you can win on, having no sacred cows, where at the end of a year, if you look and 80% of your revenue comes from the top 20% of your product line, kill the other 80%, right? And don't be afraid to do that. And don't be afraid to do NPD to backfill what you've cut so that you're constantly in test mode. You're constantly testing. A percentage of your catalog is reserved for testing and trialing so that you can find that next top 20% of revenue thing that you can then say, look, we're going to add that as an evergreen product to our catalog. But you should always have a percentage of your catalog that's churning, because you're getting rid of the stuff that is underperforming and you're bringing in new stuff that may perform. So I think this is really sound advice.
One last thing, little bonus. I spent a little bit of time doing six-figure in a day product launches for brands, in between my time at brands and on the SaaS side. And that exact point is how you absolutely blow the doors off. Limited edition drops. Take your core form factor, whether it's colors, sizing, designs, you figure out what makes the most sense and just survey your customers. Hey, what? We sell it in black. Do you want it in colors? We sell it in colors. Do you want it in black? We make this size. Do you want bigger, smaller, A, B, C, D? And throughout the year, just cycle those through, whether it's seasonal, whether it's around events. That is an absolute barn burner for your brand, because it naturally creates urgency and it naturally creates a reason for people to come back. And you will always be surprised by the collectors where, you know, you think that people are only going to buy one of this thing, they'll buy four of them because they want it in all the different variants and they collect them the same way that someone would collect like a movie.
Or they want to arbitrage it and they want to resell it into the market. It's like the limited edition Nike collectors that want to look you up and spend overnight in a line because then they want to buy 20 of that thing and they want to sell 19 and keep one pair for themselves. So this exactly. is this whole limited edition, this FOMO, the fear of missing out. If you can create FOMO in your customer base. Even Whitaker's Chocolate has done this with their limited edition chocolate bars, their limited edition collabs with L&P Cola. And they've partnered with a chocolate milk brand. And they've done these really novel, I think, partnerships where there's some overlap there, create some FOMO, creates a limited edition product that everybody goes, I like these two things separately, but together, oh my God, just it's like peanut butter and chocolate, match made in heaven.
And it's a great strategy for retail.
And also, I think that I think thinking of really novel collaborations in itself is the name of the game. It's how can we partner with other already really famous brands? We can attract their halo and vice versa. And we can say it's Ford collaborating with Eddie Bauer for the Eddie Bauer edition of the Explorer, for example. There's some really super interesting collabs in the market that you wouldn't naturally think, oh, that feels like it fits with that. But then when you see it, then you go, ah, that's a no, like after it's been done, after the deal's been done, then it makes perfect sense. But before you get, and so I think business owners and business leaders need to start being really creative about their collaborations, because I think there are so many opportunities out there to cross-pollinate your customer base that why wouldn't you want to get the halo effect going bi-directionally?
Yeah, exactly. So not everybody can go to the massive brands and tap into that. And I think that's the mistake that everybody's like, oh, I want to do collabs, but I need to do it with the biggest brand or the biggest influencer in this space. That's the biggest mistake you could possibly make. Find a micro influencer who already loves, likes, and endorsing is promoting your brand. Create a simple deal where they either get a kickback, a royalty, something, and just design a new product, have them involved in the process, and then have them promote it and call it their thing. That will be a great way because exactly what you said, right? It's an eyeball arbitrage. You get their audience in because they're promoting it, because they're incentivized to, and because they're excited about it. It gives your customers something new and interesting to buy if they find that affinity between those two things. And then you'll probably get some sort of word of mouth earned media off of it because it, at least in your community, like maybe major publications aren't picking it up and it's not going to be on the news, but other people in your community are talking about it because like, oh, that's cool. I like what they're doing. And I'll go back. I'm just going to be the Crocs guy. I'm the Crocs fanboy today. That is exactly Crocs playbook. And they do it strategically to the point where it's just all about that chatter and that word of mouth. For some of the product launches, they don't even care whether they do well because you're just talking about what they're doing. And it just built this own little ecosystem. ELF, the makeup brand, does it the same.
Oh, yes. Right? Yeah.
Why do I need lipstick that tastes like a Chipotle burrito? You probably don't. You probably don't even actually want that. I don't know. I don't wear lipstick. I'm not an ELF customer. I don't really understand it. But when everybody talks about the new thing, that again is just another free arbitrage to get people into your brand, to get people talking about you. And it doesn't always need to be a massive product success. As long as you figure out the economics of what else are they going to, can that audience buy something from my brand that's super valuable? Obviously, you want to sell out of everything. But there's many layers of benefit to that strategy.
So what you're saying is weird is good, or at least it can be. If it gets people talking, regardless of why they're talking, that what does they say? The only kind of bad attention is no attention.
Exactly. Yeah. Six people may hate your collaboration. And on the other side of those six people are three people who bought your product. And I'll take that math any day because 60% of your audience is 60% of your whole TAM is never going to buy anyway.
And it can create engagement, even if it's quote unquote negative engagement. But you put up this collab, you put up an image of a new product on Instagram or whatever. And even if 90% of the comments in the thread are negative and saying, what are they thinking? That looks terrible. I would never buy that, whatever. It vigs engagement, right? So the reality is it gets eyeballs on the brand and it pushes that content up the feed. And I think I extend this even into my content, right? I'm not intentionally incendiary, meaning I'm not out there to intentionally offend people, but I have very strong opinions on things based on my background, based on my experience, based on my point of view. I actually have a point of view and I'm not too worried about if that cuts the wrong way, if it offends people, if it maybe doesn't agree with the mainstream thinking on a subject. COVID, for example, I have my own take on that. And I'm really transparent about that. And so I think that people go out of their way to not be offensive in some respects, and they deny their own truth in the process. And unfortunately, what that leads to is such a vanilla beige experience that you blend in as if you were background noise. And I think that goes for individuals building a personal brand, but I also think it relates to brands building a brand. And the reality is if you need to have, you need to take a position, you have to take a position in the market. It is actually, I would argue that it's your opinion on the market that leads to the products that you create. You have an opinion on something. You think this thing needs to exist in the world because it doesn't today. And you're out there putting that thing into the world because that's your opinion of how the world should look. You're moving the world steadily towards that way you think the world should look. So I think that being a little bit edgy is probably the word I would use. Being a little bit edgy can have massive benefits.
Yeah. I always say, if someone doesn't hate you, you haven't built a real brand.
It's so true. It is so absolutely true. And what are the, when you look to invest in these businesses, obviously, if you're taking over a distressed brand, you take them over holistically and maybe buy the debt or whatever it is. But if you are looking to just invest in a brand, what is the minimum ownership stake you would typically like to see in the brands that you invest in? Is it that 10%, 20%, 30%, 50%+? What is the minimum ownership level you'd like to see in the brands that you, because obviously you need to have enough of a share that you can have some influence on the brand, right?
Yeah, definitely. So for the brands we're investing in growth rounds, it's typically between 30 to 51%. Mm-hmm. And depending on the deal, there'll be secondary as well. That's probably all conversation for a whole other podcast.
Yeah, secondary is an interesting one, especially if insiders are selling shares or if you've got a follow-on round or a bridge round that you can participate in on a pro rata basis, then we start getting into some complex cap tables and nuances. But and that's why I love listening to Jason Calacanis and some of the other big investors in the industry, because you start to understand what these deals can look like and how creatively they could be structured, because there's almost as many ways to do a deal as to agree a price.
Yeah, and that's my favorite part. That's also why I stopped investing a lot in the public market, is the private markets, whatever the deal gets done, the deal gets done. So you can get incredibly creative. Like, I think a lot of people just think of exiting a business as someone gives you a pile of money and you just walk away. Not to burst anybody's bubble, but that's almost how no deals ever get done, even those big deals that grab a lot of headlines. And so it can be incredibly creative. It truly is. Going back to 500 years ago, you have a thing. Hey, what do you want for that thing? And there are some rules and legal processes around it, but outside of those things, you can get very creative, which is always part of the fun for me.
It's fair game. It's fair game. And Jeremy, this hour has absolutely flown by. You're just such an awesome dude. And I'm so glad we finally made this conversation happen after talking about it, I think, for the last 2 years. But if somebody wants to reach out to you, I'll drop your LinkedIn link into the show notes and also your website, your investment website link as well. But how do you like people, if somebody's got a DTC brand and they're either distressed or they're looking for a strategic investor or strategic advisor, how do you like people to reach out to you and have a conversation with you?
Yeah, best and easiest way is just hit me up on LinkedIn, Jeremy Horowitz, Horowitz. The other benefit of that is I post now 2 times a day, something helpful, econ related. And then now sort of a newsletter called Let's Buy a Biz. Jason has been an awesome guest, not just an incredible host, on that newsletter as well. Basically, every week we tear down a public e-commerce brand. We go through the financials. We show you what it could look like if it was run better. Obviously, a biased opinion from myself. Yeah, those would be the 2 best places.
Absolutely love it. Now, this is where I get to flip the script, turn the microphone over to you, and let you ask me one question. Any question you like can be personal or professional. So, Jeremy Horowitz, managing partner of Because Ventures, what is your question for me today?
I love this concept, and I also love that it's a surprise. I had no idea this was coming. Yeah, So you're on the ground, and I actually am fascinated with this. So I have a bet that Mexico will become one of the most important manufacturing hubs of the next decade. Like, you're there. What is your 10-year bet on Mexico and how it plays into our ecosystem?
Could not agree with you more. It's already starting to happen. In fact, we've seen that the peso, the Mexican peso, which is now affectionately called the super peso, has been the second best performing currency in the world over the last 2 years. And I'm feeling that pinch because as someone who's bringing in NZD and USD and bringing in other currencies into and converting into pesos, because this is now where I live, the peso has crushed all other comers for 18 months now. And that is largely due to nearshoring and dual shoring as a follow-up to COVID. There have been massive American companies that have moved either all of their manufacturing from East Asia into Mexico because there's a number of reasons for that. It's not just because of how horribly China handled COVID and shut down manufacturing for a very long time. It's also access to natural resources, human resources, and easy cross-border logistics. It's primarily those three things that have made Mexico such an attractive option. Also, a very young working population. The average working age in Mexico is about 10 years younger than in the United States, New Zealand, and Australia. It's a very young, dynamic population. They also have some of the most immigration-friendly policies in the world. They were really smart during COVID. They kept their borders open. They actually moved up one level in the global GDP stakes during COVID because they kept manufacturing. They had very short lockdowns. They had no jab mandates. And you didn't even have to have a negative PCR test to come into the country during COVID. Of course, Mexico was one of the few countries in the world that you could travel to as a tourist pretty much with no restrictions during COVID. So they did very well. From a manufacturing perspective, pretty much all manufacturing in Mexico was considered essential. And so they manufacturing pretty much did not stop. There are also a couple of other things working very favorably in Mexico's favor from a manufacturing hub perspective. There are a tremendous number of digital entrepreneurs in this country, and I've featured a couple of them on my podcast, where they are bridging the gap between manufacturers who don't know how to go out and market themselves to the world. So China has been very successful at marketing themselves to the world, but a lot of the world doesn't know how to get into and reach out to manufacturers in Mexico. So there's a couple of online platforms now that basically are acting as the middlemen, bridging the gap between buyers and manufacturers, or between brands and manufacturers, that are streamlining and digitalizing that entire process end to end. So I think Mexico is just going to see, and we're already seeing that. We have Tesla building a gigafactory here. We have massive aerospace manufacturing being done here in Puebla and in Querétaro. We have in Puebla, where I live, the largest VW and the largest Audi factories outside of Germany are based here in Puebla. So there's a lot of structural reasons why I think manufacturing is going to grow in Mexico. But if I had to boil it down to just one or two things, it is the access to natural resources and human capital. Those are the two things that if you don't have those, doesn't matter how much the demand is. If you can't meet the demand, then you'll never grow. And Mexico can meet the demand.
Yeah, the other crazy thing to me, I think I saw a stat like a year ago that for unskilled labor, like not complicated consumer electronics, labor is actually cheaper in Mexico than it is in China right now. And when you just add
it is now.
Yeah, when you add that plus how much cheaper it's got to be just to get it from the factory to your DC if it's in North America, like that. Yeah, that's just a massive game changer. I would assume so many brands are going to move production, especially considering what is it like 75% of Shopify sites are apparel and beauty and cosmetics. And then CPG is also a massive just component of that. I would assume so many are going to move back into the next 10 years. And yeah, if you can actually request off of your question, if you can send over the links to those like connections and marketplace websites, I would love to look into that. Because yeah, finding a supplier in China was the worst until Alibaba.
Yeah, totally. In fact, one of the guys that I recently had on my podcast, he's ex-Alibaba, and he is building a company to be the Alibaba of LATAM. So he's got the experience with Alibaba, and he basically wants to recreate the exact same thing, but in Mexico.
Also, if he's looking for investors, I'd love to invest.
Oh, he is. He's already got a big investment round, but he's also looking for follow-on rounds as well. So I'll definitely hook you guys up. Jeremy, this has been a fantastic conversation. I've super enjoyed it. Hours absolutely flown by. Can't wait to do this again soon, my friend. You've been an incredible guest mentor, and I'm sure my audience is going to love it. Thank you so much, man.
Likewise. Really appreciate it, Jason.
If you'd like to get mentored by Jason for free, head over to greenwoodconsulting.net, scroll to the bottom of the page, and click Get Mentored by Jason.